Hartsburg. Anyone know where that is? No, that's a nice airport. I'm just kidding. I tried my best to get her to tell me some war stories or something that I could relate to you folks when introducing her, and she says the only war story she has is she's a 12th step worker Al-Anon member, and that's the only story she has to tell. So I'm sure we're going to enjoy our speaker tonight. And with that, I would like to introduce Wilma Kay. I believe Wilma is from Louisville, Kentucky. I don't believe, I know. Wilma's from Louisville, Kentucky. And it's a distinct pleasure for me to introduce to you folks tonight, Wilma Kay. Wilma?
My name is Wilma Kessler. I'm a member in good standing of the Monday Study Al-Anon Family Group in Louisville. Hi.
Hi.
This is not a Lauren Bacall impression. I have laryngitis. I woke up this morning croaking, and I thought I'm going to have to call and tell them I'm sorry, this is as loud as it's going to get. Which one? This one. When I woke up this morning, I could not talk, and I thought I'll have to call Jean and tell her. And I thought, I can't possibly do that to anybody. I've been involved with enough conventions to know you don't do that at the last minute. So I simply turned it over and got on this strange little airplane, and here I am. Normally, you can hear me across the field without a microphone. And my throat is kind of sore and scratchy, and if I fade out, we know. And my knees will calm down pretty soon, and all these things will go away. I need first to thank Jean for inviting me here. I've heard about Jackson's Mill, and I like a lot of good conferences and conventions. You hear about them and you wonder, so I get to find out about your wonderful Jackson's Mill. She wrote me a letter and told me that Don Johnson was going to pick me up. Thrills me. And he did. I do have to thank the two Dons who found me wandering around the great metropolitan airport of Clarksburg. It wasn't too hard. I carry my identification. It's called One Day at a Time.
Now we've spotted.
Right. Well, I only know one thing. I've been taught to tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, so I just jump in somewhere. I am the oldest of nine children, and I was born in Louisville. I grew up feeling unloved, unwanted, and unnecessary, and I carried that feeling throughout my life. And it has only been through the grace of God and the 12 steps of Al-Anon that I found out that life is worth living, that I am lovable, and that people do like me. And that's a great accomplishment for somebody who knew they were worth nothing. I grew up in the slums. My parents divorced when I was 13. I don't think my father was alcoholic. I know he was a compulsive gambler, and that's an illness, and it caused a lot of devastation in my home. I grew up thinking I was not as good as, and I was always different. I was the ugly duckling and the one that nobody wanted anything to do with, because our family was different from other people's families. All I remember are a lot of fights, mother being pregnant and daddy being gone. Somehow they got together, but that's how I remembered it. I always wanted to be something special. I always wanted to be noticed. I had an ambition as a child. I wanted to grow up and be an opera star, but I don't like opera, so I had a problem. That does explain a whole lot about me. When you stop and think about it, what I wanted to be was the furthest thing from what I was. And there was nothing further from Louisville, Kentucky than to be an opera star. I never wanted any part of marriage. I thought all it is fighting and babies and doing without. But when I was 15, I met this guy who had this band, and he was drunk, and I was impressed. You're impressed pretty easily when you're 15. And Don Kessler was a name I had heard bandied around for quite a while. It's all the girls dated Don, and I couldn't figure out what he saw in me. And I was just real impressed with my God. He asked me out. Well, to make a long story short, this person who was never going to get married 2 weeks past her 16th birthday did. And I got married for a reason. I was tired of taking care of the house, looking after kids, cooking and cleaning. With my mother's house and my mother's kids. But you see, back in the olden days when I got married, the only way a good girl got away from home was either she went to school or she got married. And I couldn't even get out of high school, so I got married to get away from home. And my husband got married for much the same reason. Now, neither one of us was honest enough to admit it to the other. I mean, I thought I was in love, and I was really in lust. And that's about it. I remember sitting in the bathtub on the day I got married thinking, I don't want to do this. This is not a good thing for me to be doing, but it was too late. You know, we'd already set out invitations, so I couldn't not do it. Well, the first 2 years that we were married, we had fun. We played house. We lived in a little one-bedroom, or a little one-room, bedroom, kitchen, living room, everything all combined, in a basement. I learned to drink right along with Don. I started a lot younger than a lot of alcoholics I've met, and I drank very heavy for a long time trying to keep up with him. So, as I say, the first 2 years were fun. He had a band, and he bagged groceries in the daytime and played music at night, and I went with him, and it was fun games. But about 2 years after we married, our first child was born, and that's when my problems with the disease of alcoholism began. Because somebody had to stay home and take care of this baby, and I was the one elected to do that. Right away, I had problems with my feelings about my daughter. I loved her, but I resented the change that it made in my life. Now, I was just, well, not quite 18 when she was born, almost. That's pretty young. And all of a sudden, I'm trying to stay home and take care of a house and take care of a baby. And I began to be aware of how much my husband drank. Up until then, he did a lot of funny things, and sometimes they were embarrassing, and sometimes we had a few arguments, but they weren't bad. But when I stopped drinking with him, I noticed how much he drank and how often he was gone. And we started having a lot of arguments and a lot of fights and a lot of doing without. A couple of years after this, things had really gotten bad for us, and we decided that what was wrong with our marriage was me. I'm a complete introvert, and he's an extrovert, and those two don't mix, so somebody had to get help, and it was me. And I went to our local hospital. We had a psychiatric clinic, and I went down there scared to death that somebody would think I needed to be there. But I went every Friday. Faithfully. It cost $3 a visit. Think how long ago that had to have been. That long ago, I was looking for help with a disease, and I didn't know it, but I knew there was something wrong with us. I tell you this because it was very important. I went every Friday, and I saved my receipts. By this time, Don and I were having a lot of knockdown, drag-out fights, a lot of arguing. He was a daily drinker. A lot of times he drank 3 or 4 days in a row without coming home, and I wouldn't know where he was, and that does lead to a few problems. One of the ways that he used to control me was he would threaten suicide. If I didn't get off his back, he was going to kill himself, and I would immediately apologize to him for what he'd done to me, and we'd live happily ever after for a little while. This one particular night, Don was really, really drunk. He came home and we had an argument, and he took a gun out and he said he was going to blow his brains out, and he had had a $10,000 insurance policy and I was going to be rich the rest of my life. And I said, fine, go ahead, sounds good to me. And I left, walked into the bedroom, and with that the gun went off, he screamed and a thud hit the floor. And I very calmly called the police and said, would you come and get this dead body out of my living room? My husband's killed himself. And he came running and yanked the phone out of the wall. do that a lot. The police did come. And in within 5 minutes, I'm sure they were there. And this man, who had been too drunk to stand up without holding on to the wall, was sober instantaneously. And he found these $3 receipts where I'd been going to see the psychiatrist. You're ahead of me, aren't you? He got the police off into this corner and showed them the receipts, told them how hard it was to live with a crazy woman. It ended up they gave him back his gun, told me to straighten up or they'd put me away. This frightened me. And I lived with this fear. And I still have traces of this fear. I've been in Al-Anon a long time, and every once in a while it pops up. But you see, I knew he could do whatever he wanted to do and get away with it. He had had drunk driving charges. He had bribed judges and policemen to get out of them. No matter what he did, he'd embezzled money. He didn't have to go to jail. Don always came out on top. And he'd tell me, if you don't straighten up, I'll take the kids away and have you put away. And I knew that he would and could. I never doubted it. And that kind of fear crawls inside your soul and it eats you alive. I was afraid of him physically because there was physical violence. But more than that, I was afraid of him emotionally. My self-esteem wasn't very tall when I got here. When I met Don, I really was not anything. And I took my whole existence from him. I was his satellite, his shadow. It was always Don's life. I was never a person. And you see, society looked down on my husband. Society does look down on alcoholics. It's the lowest form of life. And the alcoholic in my life looked down on me. I caused it. The guilt that I felt was enormous. And the shame that I felt was even bigger. You see, I thought I was the one that made this man that way. I didn't know that the night I met him, he was already alcoholic. I didn't know alcoholic. I just knew that when he was sober, he was a very nice person. He worked very hard, very bright. And somehow I always said or did the wrong thing, and I made him get drunk, and I made him do a lot of very bad and disgusting things, and therefore I wasn't a very nice person. We went on like this for quite a while. I'm going to try and condense it because the first part of my life is not important anymore. We have two children. There are almost 6 years between them. When our son was born, we were in the really active throes of alcoholism. I gave birth to a child and to a postpartum depression, which lasted for a long time. My doctor wanted to hospitalize me. But like most alcoholics that I knew back then, we never had any hospitalization, no money for doctors or hospitals or insurance, and we couldn't afford to put me in a hospital. I wouldn't see a psychiatrist because, you see, 4 years prior to that, I had seen a psychiatrist. I saw him for a whole year, and I didn't get any better. And I can tell you now why I didn't get any better. It seems that you're supposed to tell these people the truth, and that hadn't occurred to me. I was deeply ashamed of my background and my childhood. I would not talk about it to anybody. I felt guilty and responsible for my husband's drinking, and I didn't want anybody to know that I was the one that was making him do this. So I went to the psychiatrist every week and made up stories and expected him to make me well. I really did. And when he didn't, I was thoroughly disappointed and disgusted and knew psychiatrists were phony. When I really needed one, when I really needed help, I refused to go. And so my obstetrician did the next best thing. He put me on tranquilizers. Another doctor had me on diet pills because I have a weight problem and I've had one for many years. And so I started on a 3-year addiction that I didn't know was an addiction until I'd been in Al-Anon for a long time. But I would get up in the morning and I would have absolutely no energy. I'd be wore out and I'd have to take one of these little green Dexedrine pills to give me some energy to cope with these two kids. And then I'd start cleaning the house and walking on the ceiling with the flies, and I was so nervous I couldn't stand it. So I'd have to take a tranquilizer to cool down be able to take care of these children, and pretty soon I'm sitting on the couch watching television, and I couldn't do anything, so I'd have to take a pill to get some energy to do things. This was long before people knew you could be addicted to prescription medicine, and I don't want to leave you hanging, because we couldn't afford to pay our doctor. 3 years later, I had to go to a new doctor who spotted my dependency and got me off the pills, and I'm very grateful. I don't take anything stronger than aspirin unless they force me to. That's sort of jumping ahead of myself. In the eight years between my daughter's birth and when my son was 2 years old, we had three homes. We bought a house. 2 years later, we lost it. House, furniture, car, and all. And I thought, God, I can't stand this. I'm going to die. You see, I was a materialistic person. By the time I was married, I had lived in 67 different houses that we could remember. That's a lot of houses. I had no home base. And so I had a home of my own, and they took it. And I really thought I'd die. But my husband is a realtor. He's alcoholic, and he's unique. He bought us a better house. 2 years later, we lost that house. And I thought, can't do this twice. But we did. And he bought us a bigger house. And guess what happened 2 years later? We lost that one too. So due to the disease of alcoholism, I have lost three homes, complete with things that go in them. And each time I thought I couldn't live through it. And I will guarantee you, the fear and the worry and the thinking about it was much worse than the doing of it. I never gave my husband credit. He worked. He provided very well. I never starved to death. I never did get set out on the street corner, but I always knew I was going to. We did play games with the lights and gas, the water, the phone. You know, they'd turn them off. I learned as a child how to turn the electricity back on, how to turn the water back on. Mother taught me. I remember real well one winter I was out in the middle of the yard with a pan scooping water out of this hole in the ground, so I turned the water back on. And my neighbor came out and caught me and asked what I was doing. And I thought I was fixing the leak. They finally started padlocking. When they turn it off, they put a padlock on so I couldn't turn it back on. I don't think any of those things are particularly unique to me. I've found since that they've happened to a lot of you too. But at the time, I was the only person in the whole world that lived through this. I think that was the worst part of it, that feeling of being the only one. I didn't know anybody else that lived through this. I didn't know anybody else that had a husband like mine. It seemed to me I always lived next door to normal neighbors. You know, the man that played ball with the kids and cut the grass and washed the windows and ate all those things on time. I didn't know what that was about. And I hated those people. God, I hated them. I was so full of anger and resentment. And yet, trying to keep up a front so nobody'd find out about us. It's really kind of crazy. We get real sick. The summer of 1964 was probably the worst in my life. I didn't think things could get much worse. We were going to lose our home, I knew that, if he didn't start working, start doing something. It seemed like all we did was fight. All the kids did was cry. And all I did was try and find a way out. I was desperately looking for something to change about myself so that he wouldn't want to drink the way he drank. And I remember one night, I was tired. Have you ever had that feeling that you're so tired you just can't do it anymore? Well, I couldn't do it anymore. The doctor had long since, about 6 months before that, I guess, gotten me off all these pills. But I'm a pack rat. I don't throw things away. I had saved all those pills. And so I decided not to kill myself, just that I couldn't do it anymore. So I took those pills. It wasn't meant for me to die. Obviously, I'm here. God had some plan. My husband that night brought home an after-hours band with him. Now, he used to do a lot of strange things, and I'd wake up and find odd people in my house, but this was a whole band he brought home. I don't know, they found me. They poured coffee down me. They walked me. They did a lot of strange things. I don't really remember much of that night. All I know is the next morning, it occurred to me, my God, what would have happened to my children? You see, I didn't think about he's going to be sorry. I didn't think about who's going to take care of my children. All I thought about was I was too tired. I just couldn't go on anymore. And I just wanted to rest. That fall and winter, I don't even like to think about it. I'm sure it was no worse for me than it was for you, but it was as bad as I could handle it. Christmas came. My father gave me some money to buy presents for my kids. Church gave me a basket of groceries. We were losing our house, and this was the last house. I knew it. Don was no longer employable, and yet we're keeping up our front. Heaven forbid that the neighbors find out. He was a member of the JCs, and we'd gone to a New Year's Eve dance. And while we were at the dance, we had our usual ugly scene. My husband, sober, has not a jealous bone in his body, but when he was drunk, it was really bad. I think I danced with his best friend, and he went out to the car and got his gun, came in, put it to my head, and pulled the trigger. And he had put the clip in crooked, and it jammed. They took it away from him, and we got him home. And the next morning when he woke up, and we told him what he did, he didn't remember. And I knew he didn't remember. He'd been doing a lot of things and forgetting. In the beginning, I couldn't figure out how you could lose a car or not know what you had done or where you were, but I knew that he didn't remember. And he cried, and he begged me to forgive him, and he was full of guilt and remorse, and I knew that was true. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, and I'd find him crying, hiding in the bathtub. He didn't want to be what he was. He didn't want to act the way he acted. He wasn't that kind of person. And I knew that was true. But I knew one more thing. I knew the next time it happened, I wasn't going to be so lucky. Now, I had left my husband many times. You know how we leave, and they promise to stop drinking, and we live happily ever after for a little while? Well, I had done that, yo-yoed in and out. I would leave to make him stop drinking, and he always promised he would, and I always believed him, because he always meant it. He really did mean it. But this day, that morning, when I looked at him and realized that if it were not for a crooked clip, I'd be dead, I decided to do something about me and my children. It was the first time. I do believe that when we get out of the way, God can take over. Because we were losing our house, we had to get out of it. So I found a little place to move, take the children. Don had told me if I expected to eat, I'd better get on welfare because there wasn't enough money for the both of us. And that was fine. He didn't care and I didn't care. And the day he walked out of the bank from signing it over, he physically ran into Frank. Now, Frank was one of these people that used to make my husband drink. Charlie made him drink and Bob made him drink, but Frank really made him drink. And I didn't like Frank. Frank started showing up where Don was, and I'd get these phone calls. Did you tell that SOB where I was? And I said, I wouldn't tell him where you were if you were on fire and he could spit fast. But miracle of miracles, On February the 7th, 1965, Don went to an AA meeting with Frank, and he's been sober ever since. Now, we did move, and neither one of us remember how we ended up in a different house. I had a place, and we ended up in the same house, and it was a different house, and neither one of us know how. So I guess it had been God's plan, it sure wasn't mine. But Don went to a meeting on Tuesday, and on Friday, Frank and Barbara came and picked us up and took us to a meeting, and us didn't want to go. You see, there was nothing wrong with me. That him getting sober wasn't going to cure. And I knew that. Ask me, I'd live in a tent by the river if he'd just sober up. Of course, I lied about a lot of other things, too. But I thought that was true. But I went on Friday night. We went into a discussion meeting. We arrived late, and they were talking about their character defects. And first one thing, and the awful things they were telling about themselves. And I thought, my God, that's all I need is a room full of sick old women. But I've always been a phony, and I wouldn't let you know what I thought about you. They had these strange things like you have on the wall, on the wall. And I thought, gee, that's corny. Whoever heard of Easy Does It? Whoever heard of Let Go and Let God? He didn't do a very good job. All those strange things. I didn't like it. But they gave me literature and they sent me home, and I took it home and I hid it because some of the neighbors might see it and find out about Don. Now, I didn't count the fact that the guns were going off in the middle of the night and the police come on Sunday, always on Sunday, to arrest him, and you know, breaking out windows and chasing each other with knives. Those things didn't count. If I didn't tell you he was an alcoholic, you didn't know it. And I didn't want you to know about Al-Anon. Well, I went. You see, we have 12 steps. And it was a long time before I realized that the very first word was we. And I was no longer alone. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. I didn't know that. I was always the only one. And now I am one of all of us. And it's a great feeling not to be alone. And so the very first word gave me the first comfort I've ever had, but it didn't give it to me right away. It took me a long time. The second step is we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I went to the Gateway meeting every Friday night because Barbara took me. If I'd left on my own, I would not have gone. But she took me. And I came for a year. It was the following Christmas. Everything that's ever happened in my life has been the Christmas season. It was the Christmas season when he tried to kill me. It was the following Christmas season that I found a person named Mary. Barbara took me to a different meeting. Not only went on Friday, I didn't go anywhere else, but on Tuesday she took me to a different meeting and I met a girl named Mary. And I got her off in the corner and I'm telling her my sad story. My husband's sober a year, and it's not fair, but I have to get a divorce now. I cannot live this way any longer. I was more miserable than I had been when he was drunk. See, somehow it was better because he wasn't drinking, but we were still having all the fights. He was working for Frank, traveling first class to the Virgin Islands and New York and Mexico and New Orleans and all these wonderful places. And I'm staying home on $87.50 a week trying to pay $150,000 worth of bills. And I had a couple of resentments. This night I met Mary and I told her all this sad story and I could tell that she cared. Have you ever seen anybody look like they're plugged in and they glow? I know now it was her skin, but I didn't know that at the time. But Mary really tried to help me, and she didn't tell me anything about herself. And on the way home, I found out that she was married to an active alcoholic who did not have a job. She had 6 kids, and she lived in the slums that I'd crawled my way out of. And she was working the program, and it shows. Gratitude can change your attitude if you let it. And for the first time, I looked at what I had. A sober husband, lived in a nice little house, Christmas presents already bought. I had everything I'd ever said I wanted, and I was miserable. I went home and I hunted up the literature, and I had to hunt for it. I found the Guide to the Family of the Alcoholic, and I started reading it. And I said the very first prayer I've ever said in my life, a true prayer, and it was simply the word, maybe. Maybe it is me. That was my beginning. I came for a year before I came to, and I came for a lot longer before I came to believe. The power that I chose to believe in the beginning was the power of Al-Anon, and it was simply because there were more of you than there was of me. It was a long time before a higher power, whom I choose to call God, found its way into my life. I'd like to talk a little bit about restoring. About 10 years ago, I used to go junking. I don't know if you all do that, but I like to go junking to Goodwill shops and Salvation Army. I used to have to buy furniture there, and when I didn't have to, it got to be fun. But one day, I brought it home, and I decided instead of slapping paint on it like I used to, I was going to restore it. And so I did. I took all the old drawers out, and I started taking paint and varnish off, and I started sanding, and I'd get my fingers back in those dark holes and crooks. There were some broken pieces that I repaired, and it occurred to me that this was what God was doing for me. He had to strip it all away, and He's had to sand a lot of my rough edges. He's had a lot of broken things to repair. But when He gets through, I'm going to be a damn good looking piece of furniture. After I'd been in Al-Anon for about 4 years, actively working, after that first year, I started going to other groups. And I searched and found a group that I was comfortable in, a step study group. You know, we read the 12 steps, but that's all we ever did in that first group I ever went to. Back then, steps were what AA's did. Steps were what Al-Anon opened a meeting with, but we didn't do much about working them. And it wasn't until I got active working on the 12 steps that I found a life of my own. Anyway, I was about 4 years into the program. Miss Al-Anon bloomed. All of you have met me. Some of you are me. I had turned into a parrot. A parrot is kind of a dumb bird. People think they're smart. But if you tell a parrot, keep it simple, one day at a time, let go, let God. If you say that often enough, the bird's going to say, keep it simple, one day at a time, let go, let God. That bird doesn't know what it's saying. And I didn't either. It had no meaning for me. And it took me a long time before I ripened, rotted, and fell off the vine. You see, I thought everything was going great because I was mouthing all the things. And you had a problem, come to Wilma. She'll tell you what step and what slogan to use. I had a big problem, but I didn't have anybody to talk to about it. I hadn't found a relationship with a God of my understanding. Not really. I used a little lip service on that. I had a sponsor that I didn't trust. That's not a real good way to work the program. Anyway, there was a crisis in my family, and I fell apart. I couldn't cope. And I ended up in the local nut house, January the 3rd, Christmas season. You see, there are bottoms, and there are bottoms, and there are other bottoms. But I had been in Al-Anon 4 years. And I had never worked any of those steps. I sort of did a first one, and I did a little bit of a 12th one, but those things in the middle, just, I talked about them. I didn't work them. I went to that hospital, and I didn't believe in God. I didn't love my husband. I didn't love my children, and I didn't want to live. And you can't get much more desperate. I was there for 3 months. I didn't have any medicine. I didn't have any shock treatment. What I had was a fourth and fifth step. You see, I had never done that. I was too ashamed. But that's what it took. The very first fourth and fifth step, I want you to know I've had many others since then. The first one wasn't a very good one, but it was a beginning. I came out of that hospital and I was different. I had a hole inside me. The AAs describe it like the wind blowing through you. That's how it felt. It hurt. Something very precious had been taken from me. But God doesn't take something away unless he gives you something better, and I guarantee you that. Because what he gave me literally were your children. I was asked to sponsor an Alateen group, and nobody was less qualified than me. I had a teenager of my own, and I didn't like her. I didn't understand them, they made me nervous, but I had been taught, you don't say no unless you have a good reason, and an excuse is not a reason. And for whatever reason, I said yes. And that was the beginning of 9 years of discovery. The Hikes Point Alateen group was the first place I have ever walked into and felt love. There's love in this program in Al-Anon and AA, but I didn't feel it. I wouldn't let it be. But those kids loved me. I learned. I had to dig into my literature just to stay a half a step ahead of them. They're smart. They love for fun and for free. They're conning little creatures, but they love you. They'll tell you out of WSO that you don't sponsor the group that your own child's in. And I'll say, maybe. But I sponsored both of my children through Alateen and it worked. I learned how to deal with my children by learning how to deal with yours. My daughter and three other little girls came to me and says, if you don't be our sponsor, they're going to kick us out of the church and we won't have a meeting anymore. And so we decided between us that in the Alateen room, I was the sponsor. I was not mother. And nothing would be brought from the room into the house. And it worked. I am so grateful. So grateful. A lot of things have gone on in my life. I'm very, very blessed. But the one thing that I never had, that all of you all, every one of you all had, was a happy marriage. I believed it. You see, I had a lot going for me in Al-Anon. I have been given a lot of blessings, a lot of abilities that I never knew I possessed. I have. I had everything that I wanted except a relationship with the man that I wanted a relationship with. Don and I still have a hard time together. But for a bunch of years there, it was like one-upsmanship or brinksmanship. We'd go to a certain point and we couldn't stand it anymore and we'd decide to get a divorce and then something would happen and we wouldn't have to and we'd back off for a while. You know, that ebb and flow. You know, that lonely feeling when there's just two of you in a car and you don't have anything to talk about and you wish to God there's somebody else there to have a conversation with because you don't know what to say. The feeling when there's nobody in the house except the two of you and you want him to go away so you can do something. And I can't explain it if you haven't felt it, but I have never been so alone. And I know that he felt the same way. And yet we're still struggling. There came a time in my life when I had been doing this a lot. When I looked at the third step and saw what it really said, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And I woke up one morning angry and defiant. And I told God, okay, if it's got to be this way, if I'm going to live this way the rest of my life, that's all right. You're going to show me how. If I'm supposed to get a divorce, you're going to teach me how. If I have to stay married, you're going to teach me how. You are going to take care of me. And he has. And I was led, I thought, right down the path to divorce. You see, I got married at 16, so I didn't get out of high school. I went back, finished high school, got a little college in my belt, got a real estate license, did a lot of strange things that I wasn't capable of doing. All the time thinking, God is leading me right down that path. And that was okay. And for years when I'd talk, I'd say, every day I'd get up and I'd make the decision, today I'm going to stay married. Don made the decision to stay sober, I made the decision to stay married. And it worked. It really did. Somehow, There was a knowing inside of me. I can't explain it. I've had a lot of strange things in my life, but I have always known since that day that I was being taken care of. I have since made other fourth and fifth steps. The first one was a fearful, immoral inventory. But the searching and fearless moral inventory was not a list of what I had done. It was an inventory of what I was. And my fifth step, I think the hardest part of the fifth step was to admit to myself. Not to God, He already knew. It wasn't too hard to admit to another human being. It was too hard to admit to myself the exact nature of my wrongs. Not the list of sins I had done. It was the motives and the reasons behind what I had done. If I didn't look behind my actions and find out what caused them, I was doomed to keep repeating them. I found that in my inventory, things kept happening over and over and over, and I think, God, am I never going to learn? And I wasn't going to learn until I found out what was behind them, the attitudes and the motives. And that's the exact nature of my wrongs. For me, the sixth step, I thought was going to be a breeze. I went through it. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. You see, I wanted to be better. I didn't want to get better. And there is a difference. Being better meant God was going to zap it all away and it was going to be fine. Getting better involved a lot of hard work on my part. I would like to have all my defects of character removed, instantly and forever. I don't particularly like having to keep working on the same ones over and over and over and over and over, but until I get it right, I'm doomed to do that too. But only God can do it. I cannot will it away. As strong-willed as I am, I have to remember to ask Him on a daily basis to remove them. And He does, on a daily basis. I humbly ask Him to remove my shortcomings, and it's not real easy for me to be humble. To me, humble equated humiliation, and I had enough humiliation in my life. I didn't want any more. For me now, humbly is to know that God is here, and I am here, and I know who's in charge. And I know if I ask Him, expecting it to happen, it will happen. And for me, humility is just knowing the truth. Made list of all persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. When I first ran into the brick wall of what I had done to my children, it was devastating. You see, I thought my husband was responsible for my kids being the way they were. After all, he was the drunk. He was the one that was violent. The first time I heard my daughter talk, I thought I was going to die. She was afraid of me. She wasn't afraid of her daddy. You see, she instinctively knew that when he was acting that way, it was because he was drunk. But I did a lot of screaming and a lot of hitting and a lot of ignoring and a lot of making him go away, stone sober. There was no reason that she could see for me to act that way. I was absolutely and totally obsessed with my husband and his drinking. I didn't have time to be a mother. I would sit on the couch for hours thinking. You know how tired you can get thinking? My mind was like a squirrel cage, just going crazy a mile a minute, and I tell the kids, go away, don't bother me, I'm busy. I had not loved my children. I felt love for them, but I didn't show it. And I had to go about making restitution for that. That's one of the first things I did in this program, was learn to kiss my kids goodnight. And at first, Donna pushed me away. She didn't want any part of me. And I can't say that I blame her, but it hurt. I didn't want that rejection. I wanted her to fall into my arms, you know, like a loving little girl. Didn't work. But through the Al-Anon-Al team program, it did. And eventually, we had a really blooming love affair between me and my kids. Today, both of my children are married. I have two grandchildren. And we have a great friendship going. My daughter and I respect each other tremendously as people. And I think that's wonderful. I'm so grateful because I threw it away. Made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I need to tell you a little bit about my mother. I blamed my mother for my life. You see, Daddy wasn't around very much when I was a child. I don't know where he was, doesn't really matter, but I blamed my mother. And I had done some oral making of amends. I told her I was sorry for some things I had said. But inside, I was still uncomfortable. I didn't like to go to her house. I did not like the man she was married to. It made me uncomfortable. You really want to know the truth? I was ashamed of her. And I was ashamed of myself for feeling that way. My mother still lived the same way she lived when I was a child, and it was no longer necessary, and I knew that. About 7 years ago, I think, I had taken a group of kids to Washington for a convention. Got a phone call to come home. My mother was having surgery, and she had brain cancer. And God gave me the opportunity to make amends, because for the next 6 months, the last 6 months of her life, I took care of her daily in her house, and it was the hardest thing I have ever done, but the best thing I've ever done for myself. Because when my mother died, I loved her, and I knew it. She knew it all along, but I didn't. I am so grateful. If she had died without me making amends, you see, I was able to give back in kind. I fed her and I bathed her and I diapered her just like she did me when I was a baby. And I grew to understand and to accept this woman who had a life far more miserable than mine. I am so grateful. Because if she died and I hadn't made the amends, I don't think I could have lived with the guilt. I really had a hard time with how I felt about my mother. And I'm really, really grateful that she knew I loved her. There have been other amends in my life, none of them that dramatic. I hope I don't have to do any more. By the time my father passed away, I didn't have to go through that kind of hell. I'd made him first. There are people in my life that I'd like to make amends to that I will never be allowed to. And so I've had to learn new ways. Sometimes direct means making amends and helping you when I can't help somebody else that's no longer there. It's the becoming willing that makes the difference. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Continuing to do something implies you've done it in the first place. And I tried to continue taking an inventory for 4 years when I had not taken one. And it does make it a little difficult to live well. I don't sit every day and think about my daily life as it goes by. I know people that do. I wish I had that kind of discipline in my life, but I don't. But I have learned that when I'm wrong, I have to admit it first to myself and then to the people who are involved with me being wrong. It was very difficult for me to be wrong to my husband. That's where I had the most trouble. I was always sorry, but wrong? No. I might tell you I'm wrong, but I didn't believe it. And so I had to admit it first to myself, to be less than perfect and to lower myself in what I thought were his eyes. In order to do that, I raised myself up in my own. And an awful lot of self-esteem has come about by realizing that I don't have to be perfect, that I'm just me. And that's good enough. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand him. Praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. I think probably this step has helped me more than any. You see, I've learned a lot about prayer. I used prayer like a fire truck when I was in trouble. Oh God, fix this. Oh God, fix that. oh, I'm sorry, God, I won't do it anymore if you'll just do this. But I didn't pray in a direct way. I don't know how to explain it. It was sort of like flares, I guess. But now when I pray, I think about it. I don't pray formal letters. I used to print prayers in my head on a typewriter. I don't know how to type, so I had problems with that. If I didn't get it right, he wasn't going to answer them. And now I found one day, driving around my car, the radio was broken. And it was silent. And so I started singing to God. And I just made up my songs. And my prayers are in form of song. And so now I just turn the radio off, and that's how I do a lot of praying and meditating, driving along the expressway, singing. And it works. I feel good. I think God feels good. I know He understands me, crazy as that might seem. Praying for His will is very difficult for me. You see, there are a lot of things in my life that are going on that I hadn't liked. I learned that I don't have to like what I have to accept. My husband and I were still having a lot of problems 5 years ago. Christmas. New Year's Eve, sitting out in Florida on a patio. Another couple had come with us. They went home. They couldn't stand the tension. Left us there. And Don and I decided when we got back home we were going to see an attorney, that we couldn't do it anymore. Not angry anymore, not blaming one another, just knowing that it was over. When you get out of the way, God can take over. The people we had been to Florida with happened to be our next door neighbors, and he happens to be an orthopedic surgeon. And I had developed a limp. They had been treating me for a condition, bursitis. And he decided that my limp looked a little funny, so he said, well, when you get back to Louisville, come over to the office and we'll take an x-ray. I went back to Louisville, I think January 4th or 5th, something like that. 2 days later, we were supposed to see an attorney, but the day before we saw the attorney, go over and get an x-ray. And he says, what's that done? Maybe we better have a CAT scan. So I got a CAT scan. Well, maybe we better have a little biopsy. It ended up I had bone cancer. Scares the hell out of me. Somehow, after about 30 minutes of blind, unadulterated panic, and that's pure panic, the only thought that creeped into my mind was call Ruth. Ruth was my sponsor. And I called Ruth, and within 20 minutes, there's my group, a whole bunch of them. They were there. They supported me. And though the fear was there, the panic was gone. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. But somehow, I knew I was going to be all right. Not that I was going to live, I didn't know that. But I didn't have that fear, that paralyzing fear. I had radiation, and it's been 4 years, and it's gone. I'm completely well. Miracles do happen. The miracle wasn't that I recovered from cancer. The miracle was Don and I didn't have to get a divorce. You see, this man who, I mean, we were poles apart, totally. But when I needed him, he was there for me. He loved me. He cared for me. He supported me physically, emotionally, financially. He was really there. And I was amazed because I didn't think he could be. When you get out of the way, God takes over. I can't tell you that everything is wonderful right now. It isn't. I still don't have what you all have. But that's all right. I know today that as a result of working these steps, I've had a spiritual awakening. I am awake unto myself. When I got here, nobody liked me because I didn't like me. I have changed. I'm a totally different person. And it is strictly the results of working these steps. I tried to carry the message. The only message I know is the message Wilma Kessler stands here and tells you this is what Al-Anon did for her. I can't tell you what it's going to do for you. The hardest part is to practice the principles in all my affairs. It's real easy to be a good Al-Anon member sitting at the Monday study meeting. It's a good, easy way to live. It's real easy to be that. I'm involved deeply in service work, and I can be a good Al-Anon member at assemblies and World Service Committee meetings and host committee meetings. I can do all that. It's hard to be a good Al-Anon member in my home. My husband and I have sort of an armed truce. And it's not really that. It's not armed, but it's a truce. He spends about 75% of his time in Florida, and I live in Kentucky, and we have a long-distance relationship that works real well for the two of us. Other people think that's weird, but that's okay. It works for me. I do know that today God is doing for me what I cannot do for myself. There is no way. I couldn't talk this morning when I woke up. I've managed to talk for an hour. It doesn't even hurt right now. The things, I guess, that I want to tell you, the thing that's so important to me is that today I like who and what I am. I did not like me when I got here. There was no me. I had no being of my own. And Al-Anon has turned me into a living, breathing, worthwhile human being. And it will do the same thing for you. I know that I wasn't the only person in the world that felt unique. I know that I'm not the only one who thought everybody else had it made and she didn't have anything. I know I'm not the only one who suffered through a bad marriage. But I'm the only one that suffered through mine. I could have let that turn me into what my mother had turned into. And through this program, it didn't happen. And I am eternally grateful. I go back home on Sunday, and I will carry the love that I can feel from you. I know a couple of people in this room, I've met them before, but mostly you're strangers to me, and yet you're not. I may not know your names, but I guarantee you, I know you, just as you know me now. I thank you for sitting there patiently listening. I hope sometime during the weekend you'll come up and let's have a little private conversation. That's the kind I like. I don't like standing up trying to do it in front of a microphone. I like one-on-one. So thank you, and have a good evening.